history, raiding Rimuros itself. Of the three major islands of Rimuros, Arnot was the least populous and least defended. Without the riches of Liveros or the people of Provo, its more powerful residents had always been the only protection it needed. But with the forces of Rimuros mobilized, only a handful of teams remained. Most importantly, the only gold ranker still present was the core user Peli, who was mayor of some village. If enough monsters spawned in the area during this time, a good chance in the middle of a monster surge, then the defenders might well be drawn away from a juicy target long enough for a successful raid. For this reason, the captain had planted people in the towns of Arnot, with signal beacons to call the pirates in should the chance arise. This exact thing had happened, and the pirates had moved in on the town of Casillero. At first, things had gone exactly as expected. The team stationed there was busy fighting monsters underwater off the coast. The pirates' airship had swept in, the residents fleeing as the pirates kicked open doors, snatching anything of value. They even took the time to grab the pretty women and boys who looked fun to play with. It was around that point that things started going wrong. The gold ranker, Peli, had arrived within expectations. Any gold ranker could move swiftly enough that they would reach the town before the raiders had their fill of plunder. The captain was also a core-using gold ranker, which was a rank rare amongst pirates. It had won him the prestige he enjoyed within the pirate circles and was the source of his current boldness. His part of the plan was to keep the gold ranker busy while his first mate led the crew in continuing to loot the town. Peli did not want the collateral damage of a confrontation with the pirate captain to wreak havoc on Casillero and its residents, which was why she fought outside the town. As this exposed the town to the pirate's crew, she had called in backup. In the town, the crew hauled everything of value to the airship tethered to the ground, just beyond the town gates. They used carts and wagons pilfered from the townsfolk, as well as using the residents themselves as pack mules. Their activity centered on the town square, which made a useful transfer point for looted goods and had the main road running straight to the gates. The crew noticed that some of their number hadn't shown themselves in a while. At first, it hadn't been apparent. Those missing were the ones who'd grabbed a pretty boy or girl and dragged them into a building for some fun. When they took too long to re-emerge, the first mate became concerned. She grumbled to herself that they should have known better than to be so long about their sordid business, but pirates were not famous for discipline. She was about to go looking for them when the presence of trouble was confirmed by the missing crew's reappearance. They came staggering out of buildings, stumbling and some falling over entirely. Their skin was blackened, their limbs withered, and their eyes were full of fear. As the rest of the crew noticed them emerging, they stopped hauling loot in the direction of the airship and looked around, worried. "What happened?" the first mate asked, after she marched up to the closest of the stricken still on their feet. The man opened his mouth to speak, but only coughed black blood over her before falling to his knees. Then a cold voice spoke, echoed from points all around the town square, even though the speaker was nowhere to be seen. "Did I say you could go?" Long shadow arms emerged from dark doorways and alleys, grabbing the afflicted crew and pulling them back in. Those still standing toppled over as they were all dragged into the darkness and disappeared. The first mate was the strongest member of the crew, short of the captain himself, but she couldn't detect the speaker with her magical senses. It was unlikely to be a gold ranker, though, or he wouldn't be hiding. More likely, it was a stealth specialist looking to intimidate them. Unfortunately, she knew that her crew were bullies such intimidation would likely work on. "It's just some adventurer," she called out, leaping onto a wagon. "Hey, adventurer, unless you want us to slaughter everyone in this town, you'd best show your face." Cruel laughter came from every shadow, disconcertingly, even her own. "I didn't come here to save them," the cold voice informed her. "I came here to kill you."
"Screw this,"
one of the bronze rank pirates said, and broke out into a run. That triggered most of the others, only the few silver rankers remaining behind. The pirates ran with the sun at their backs, their shadows stretched out in front of them. A dark figure rose from the shadow of the first pirate to run, grabbed him by the neck, and gave a single, sharp shake. The fleeing pirates pulled to a stop as the figure dropped the pirate with the now broken neck. He was shrouded in a dark cloak over robes the colour of dried blood. Two strange orbs floated around him like disembodied alien eyes. Two smaller versions of those eyes watched from within a dark hood. He drew a sword with a black blade, marked with ominous red sigils. As the battle over the floating city raged, only one person stood on the coast to confront the approaching land city. The great fortress approached hidden in a storm of desert dust, kicked up by its passage. Dawn raised an arm in the air and pointed to the sky. As she moved her hand, lines of fire lit up the sky, drawing out a ritual circle even more vast than the dust cloud hiding the rolling city. When she started chanting, her words were like a tsunami, audible even over the cataclysmic sounds of the diamond rankers battling above the ocean. I call back to the origin of infinity. From the fires of creation were you born in the days before days, and from the fire shall you come again. The birth of all things marks the beginning of the end, for in creation is the promise of annihilation. In the place the end has come, so bring forth the flames of beginning, and let them mark the end. Dawn's words of fire and thunder carried out over the land and water, even the madness of the nearby battle coming to a momentary lull. All eyes turned to see the grand summoning circle in the sky. The circle closed in on itself, its lines entangling and folding over one another like a wire sculpture of white, yellow, and orange. It took on the framework of a fiery bird of barely comprehensible immensity, flames lighting up to fill in the gaps and flesh out the great phoenix blanketing the dust storm below. The sky darkened, as if the sun was trembling before a presence born of power older and greater than itself. Day turned to night when the flaming bird took on the role of a burning moon, lighting up the dark. The dust cloud beneath it burned away, combusting from the heat sweeping out from the awe-inducing firebird. The land city was silhouetted in flames as the dust cloud was burned off around it. An apocalyptic column of fire descended from the cosmic phoenix's body onto the heart of the city. From its wings came streamers of flame, twisting through the air on their way down to ravage the city's outlying districts as the center burned away. An aura, more oppressive than anything the world had felt before, crashed down on the burning city. Even the diamond rankers within, who had been readying to go and confront Dawn, were suppressed. The raw power on display did not belong to this world, but to something greater, a force from the cosmos. No defenders emerged from the city. No defenses rose to protect it. The vast city of stone and steel was melted down like slag in a foundry, along with everything in it, living or otherwise. Dawn only had one chance to intervene, and she used it to the absolute limit, showing the world a power it had never seen before and might never see again. Even the inhuman forces of the Builder battling off the coast took pause as they were struck dumb, shocked at the spectacle. Such a vast power, so beyond the limits of the world into which it was summoned, could only last a short time. The burning light of the phoenix dimmed, the sun shining brighter again as the great phoenix grew dark, slowly turning to ash and drifting away. Even with such a sight before them, the terrible carnage of the battle over the floating city could only be stalled for so long, as the ashen remains of the phoenix floated on the air like a volcano's expulsion. The brutal war resumed. Thank you, Pelly said to Jason. I couldn't stop them all before they hurt and killed some of the townsfolk. I thought you didn't come to save them. You heard that? I'm going to assume that was something you said so they wouldn't try taking hostages. Thank you. You didn't kill them all? The Bronze Rankers died too fast. The Silver Core users I was able to keep alive. But there was a woman who was more skilled than the others. No cores, maybe an ex-adventurer? Not guild level, but there was clearly some training there. I didn't take any chances with her. I felt the Gold Ranker run off. I tried to finish him, but it's hard to kill a Gold Ranker even when you are one. You need powers to outpace them, trap them, or load them up with ongoing damage. not an issue for you, I suppose. For me, the trick has always been taking them alive. I have a tool for that now, but in groups, the weak ones die too fast.
You can kill them all as far as...
Peli trailed off, as an aura unlike anything she had ever felt washed over the island. Then the sky started to go dark as the sun dimmed. Even from 1,500 kilometers away, the events to the northwest could be felt.
What in the names of the sweet gods is that?
Peli asked in a trembling voice.
It's not an eclipse. I've never felt power like that.
That's my friend Dawn, Jason said.
That's a person?
It's the power that lies between mortal and something else.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't think we're meant to. Not yet. Jason turned his gaze from the northwest, where the aura was coming from, to the east and the direction of Liveros. Now it's time to see if she was right, he said.
Right about what?
The builder's intentions. Even as the incredible aura continued to wash over the island, another vast and powerful aura erupted from where Jason was looking. It was distant, but large and high enough in the air to be visible. A massive manifestation of rainbow light had appeared in the sky. And right she was, Jason said grimly.
What is that?
Peli asked a second time. That, Jason said, is a builder fortress city, appearing over Liveros.
But all our forces have gone to the northwest.
Not all, Jason said. Just most.
Who are left? She asked. There's barely a token force left by the Adventure Society, right?
Yes, Jason said. It's just them and your family. Chapter 65. Stand at the Front. The royal family of the Storm Kingdom was extensive. Every combat-trained member of silver rank or above was gathered in a ballroom in the royal palace, one of the few rooms large enough to hold them all. From Zara and Vesper to Soromir and the Storm King, the only absent member of that group was Zila, who had gone northwest to fight in the battle there. Only untrained core users like Peli were exempted from the family call to arms. With them was the Royal Guard, all members of the Sapphire Crown Guild, representatives from the Irios family, and a contingent of clergy. Most of the church's combat forces were also adventurers and had set out for the battles in the northwest. Even so, the churches had placed their core reserves under the command of the royal family for the defense of the city.
The first part will not be the most critical, Soromir told them, standing before the gathering with the Storm King and Trenchant Maw flanking him. What it will be is the hardest. We couldn't hold back more than one Diamond Ranker, or not only would the attack on the Water City be less likely to succeed, but the Builder could realize that we were preparing for his sneak attack.
Soromir looked up through the glass ceiling of the ballroom in which they had gathered. All eyes followed his gaze to the mass of rainbow light floating high above, from which the Builder's fortress city would soon emerge.
I have no shame in claiming to be strong, Soromir said. But I am not so strong that I can handle every Diamond Rank threat the Builder cult will have ready for us. We can hope that the cult believed they would catch us unprepared and use their greater resources elsewhere, but to assume that would be folly. We can only operate under the assumption that whatever they send against us will be more than I can handle alone.
He gestured expansively around him.
Our advantage is home territory. We know that the Builder cult has limited Diamond Rank essence users and relies heavily on their creations and the power of the cities themselves. In this case, however, we can match them. We have our own city, with its own power, built up in the century since I founded this kingdom.
He nodded at the leader of the Irios family contingent.
From the first days of this kingdom, the Irios family has built the walls that shield its people in times of crises. The founder of their family was a man I called brother, and I know he would be as proud of what your family has become as I am of mine.
He glanced at the Storm King with a smile.
Every generation has made this kingdom stronger than the one before. Now the time has come to show this interloper who thinks he can destroy us the strength of what we have built together. We are the Storm Kingdom. Some of us carry the very name of this city. Others are its most staunch defenders, or the architects of its defenses. The people of this kingdom have given all of us so much. Now, in our time of greatest crisis, we will show them that their faith in us was not in vain.
Again, Soromir looked up before turning his gaze back on the crowd in the room.
The first step, as I said, will be the hardest. We have a great weapon, but the enemy stronghold is mighty. Our weapon must be carried into the heart of their city, so we can be certain of destroying it. This means breaching the city's defenses while its defenders wield the full force of their power against us. Normally that task would fall to me, but I will not be free to do so while harassed by the cult's diamond rankers. Fortunately, we are not alone. This entity has invaded our world, but our world has gods to watch over us. Archbishop Rimmon, if you would.
A man in the garb of the Church of Knowledge stepped to the front to address the group.
Even gods and beings like the Builder have rules, the Archbishop said. The Builder has been pushing against the limits of those rules, which gives our gods the leeway to push back. Thus far they have bided their time waiting for the best opportunities. One of those opportunities is now. The gods are stepping forward to protect the people of the Storm Kingdom.
Reassurance showed on the faces of the royal family, the Irios family, and the royal guard. Soromir's speech was all well and good, but they were up against forces greater than any mortal. It was a relief to know the gods would be standing with them.
Each of the gods will do what they can, Archbishop Rimmon continued. They have granted us, their representatives, miracles to aid the city. The Archbishop of War will empower the city's defenses beyond what should normally be possible. The Archbishop of Ocean will have the sea itself aid us. Knowledge has revealed to me many secrets of the Builder City, from where to place our weapon to how to breach the defenses without diamond rank assistance.
This does not mean the task ahead of us is easy, Soromir said, only that it is possible at all. Make no mistake, many of us will fall today. The price we pay for our kingdom's safety, for its very survival, will be high. But we will pay it, because that is our duty. Throughout the history of this kingdom, we have always stood at the top. Now the time has come for us to stand at the front. Jason's team, minus Jason himself, were one of many teams given a device to carry into the city. Only one was the true bomb, but once the cult realized the objective of the Rimmeros defenders, they would focus on stopping it. For that reason, many teams had been handed dummy devices, with the Church of Knowledge giving target locations within the city to activate it. As to which device and which target were the real ones, the people assigning tasks claimed not to know. Everyone would have to do their utmost to succeed in case they were the true hope for the city.
"It's definitely not our team," Neil said, as they waited on an airship docked at the Sky Tower. "No way they gave us the real thing. The cult will probably put extra effort into killing us just for being Jason's team, so giving it to us is a terrible idea."
"It'll be some gold rank group," Sophie said. "It's too important to hand over to anyone but those with the best chance."
"Unless that's exactly what they want the cult to think," Belinda said. "Maybe it is us."
"It's not," Sophie said. "They're telling everyone that no one knows who has the real thing, but that's just to motivate the rest of us. The ones who have the real thing know what they've got."
"It would be nice to have Gary, Rufus, and Farrah with us," Clive said.
"They have their own task," Humphrey said. "Farrah is a formation magic expert, and they need every one of those they can get. If we can't breach the magical defenses of the Builder City, none of this will work out." The rainbow light above the city was something between a portal and the manifestation effect of a monster or essence without exactly being either. Only possible during the monster surge, when the dimensional membrane of reality was in tatters, it faded away as it disgorged the builder's flying city. It looked like a fairly normal city, except that it was in the sky. The city rested on a massive disk of stone, with a massive and complex ritual circle engraved into the underside. The top of the city looked like any city built heavily of stone, with towers, streets, and other buildings that looked remarkably ordinary for a flying city of doom. The defensive dome glimmering over it was also common in major cities, although the fact that it was visible when not actively being attacked was unusual. The battle began. The lines of the massive ritual circle under the flying city lit up, swiftly glowing brighter until a massive beam of red-white magic shot directly down at Liveros. The ritual circle was not the mechanism by which the city flew, but a giant magic beam cannon. Liveros itself was larger than the flying city above it, the entire island being urbanized. The protection that appeared to intercept the beam was not a dome like that over the Builder City. It was a circular barrier of blue and green magical energy, looking much like a ritual circle. In the near instantaneous moment the beam descended, the shield appeared. Then another behind it, and a third behind that. The first shield wavered and then broke, even as shields continued to stack up. The second, third, and fourth shields were broken through before the beam's energy was finally expended. The glowing ritual circle under the flying city started to fade. The potent beam had pushed the ritual disc near the limit of its endurance. It would take time before it was able to fire again, and the disappearance of the beam was like the crack of a starting pistol. Airships full of adventurers started flying up from Liveros's sky docks, while cult airships passed through the flying city's dome before descending to meet them. Other enemies emerged as well, from constructs and abominations flying through the sky to the diamond rank forces the defenders of Rimuros had been anticipating. To Soromir's relief, as he flew up into the sky on a magical cloud, he only sensed one essence user at diamond rank. He sensed other diamond rank auras, but essence users were always the greater threat. He had no illusions about defeating them all, but if he could occupy the strongest of the Builder's cult forces, the gold and silver rankers had a real chance to secure victory and protect Rimuros. As he ascended, Soromir gathered power around himself, conjuring water and air to shroud himself in a miniaturized hurricane. With diamond rank speed, it took only moments to clash with his cultist counterpart, where it immediately became apparent that Soromir was stronger. That was not the same as being in a domineering position, however. No diamond ranker should be underestimated. There were two other diamond rank auras on the cultist side. One was a massive construct bird with four wings. Unlike the essence user, Soromir was confident he would be able to destroy it given the chance, although that chance was unlikely to be forthcoming. The last diamond rank aura was strange and diffuse, which Soromir found almost as concerning as the essence user. He had sensed that kind of aura before, recognizing it as the signature of swarm-type entities. As predicted, a swarm of constructs sharing a single aura came pouring out of the flying city's defense dome. The diamond rank conflict was the key to the early stage of the battle, as the Rimuros defenders needed the freedom to breach the defenses of the flying city. Formation specialists, many of whom were from the Irios family, were being carried into battle on airships, along with protective escorts. The greatest danger to them wasn't the cult forces, but the collateral damage from a diamond rank battle that was just beginning. Soromir's storm powers were formidable in the face of multiple opponents, which was exactly what he needed when outnumbered. They were effective against the swarm constructs, which, like many swarm-type enemies, were vulnerable to wide-area attacks. The drawback of Soromir's expansive powers was that the lower ranks of both sides had to stay well clear. While much of the swarm was struggling against Soromir's storm powers, clusters of the swarm managed to escape in isolation, separating from the main swarm to hunt the lower-ranked Rimuros forces. They were still diamond rank, but their components, fist-sized locust constructs, were individually frail for their rank. With their numbers reduced in the smaller swarms, the gold-rank adventurers were able to put up a fight. The battle quickly turned to chaos as the Rimuros airships tried to fight their way to the underside of the city through storms of battle and powers flying back and forth, including actual storms. The formation magic specialists needed to be delivered to the flying city's underside. Using the information given to them by the Goddess of Knowledge, they knew there were nodes not visible from a ground level on the city's ritual disk. If enough of them were impacted by the right rituals, also provided by knowledge, they could bring down the magic dome and expose the city to invasion. The flying city's beam weapon recharged before any of the Rimuros forces managed to fight their way into it. In the chaos of battle, many from both sides failed to move out of its path in time as it once more hammered at the city below. The flying city needed to be breached before Liveros was cracked open by the repeated beams. Liveros did not helplessly wait to suffer more attacks. Magic circles, similar to the shield it used, appeared over the city and fired back beams of its own. They weren't anything like the magnitude of those the flying fortress used, and wouldn't be enough to damage the ritual circle of the underside of the city. The flying city, however, was not the target. The Irios family members controlling the defences aimed the beams at the swarm construct, attempting to thin it out as much as possible and take pressure off of Soramir. Perhaps intimidated by the wild auras from the battle above Liveros and in the aftermath of Dawn's actions, the monster activity that had been raging around Anot had gone quiet. It had been unusually busy, even for a monster surge, but now it had fallen off entirely. Jason found himself back at home with Travis and Tyker, their bronze ranks relegating them to the role of civilian. Pelly had joined Jason at his cloud house, and they all sat on an upper floor deck, watching the distant battle. They could make out little at such a distance, but they watched nonetheless. "I feel helpless," Travis said. "Travis, you're the one who made this battle even viable," Jason assured him. "Without you, things would have been even more desperate."
"Assuming it even works," Travis said.
"Bro, at least you got to do something," Tyker said. "All I could do was sit here."
"You're doing something," Jason assured him.
"I am?"
"Damn right you are."
"What am I doing?"
"Looking good. You're a big, sexy chocolate drop."
"Thanks, bro," Tyker said brightly. "That's nice of you to say."
Farrah was drawing in the air with her finger, leaving behind lines of flame that formed ritual circles as she continued to draw. Their airship was hovering under one of the nodes on the underside of the city, each barely the size of a basketball. The airship was being attacked by flying cult creations and enemy airships, the adventurers around her desperately keeping the enemies away from her. Rufus was a monster, smoothly dashing around with his golden sword. Everywhere he went, a construct fell apart, its neatly cut halves glowing with heat. Gary didn't have the skill to match some of the guild adventurers around him, but his specialty tools more than made up the difference. He had long ago crafted weapons specialized in fighting cult creations, and his hammer was practically ordnance as it smashed apart constructs, sending waves of force behind the shattered enemies to batter its fellows. His shield grew and shrank as he used it to protect Farrah, the way he had failed to do years ago when she died. He let out all his pent-up rage, his Leonid roars blasting enemies overboard. The Rimuros forces managed to take down the dome over the flying city, although the price was high. Many adventurers sacrificed themselves, getting the formation experts to the underside of the city disk to perform their work. Once it was done, airships poured up and over to invade the city. The diamond rank defenders moved to stop them. Soramir had managed to destroy the weakest of them, the bird construct, but the essence user was predictably resilient. As for the swarm, that was more troublesome. The beams from below, the gold rankers fighting it, and Soramir himself had managed to shave off a large portion of the swarm, but much remained. It continued to carve off smaller swarms to hunt the Rimuros adventurers, chasing them into the city. The city itself was an odd mix of familiar and alien to the adventurers moving through it. Stone streets and buildings were not that different from what might be found in a normal city, but the denizens that emerged to fight them certainly were.
Cultists led packs of their bizarre creations, ranging from humanoid magic cyborgs to floating ring constructs that shot beams of energy. Ramon Keel was a member of the Anti-Builder Task Force. He was in charge of organizing a beachhead in the city and called out as he spotted a group of Silver Rank adventurers. "Hey!" The group came over, recognizing Keel. They had all passed through assessment by Keel's unit when they registered for Monster Surge activity. "Yes, sir," Humphrey said by way of acknowledgement. "You're Asano's team, right?" Keel asked.
"That's right," Humphrey confirmed.
"If I remember correctly, you have multiple portal and storage powers between you, right?"
"We do," Humphrey said.
"Great. I'm assigning you all to logistics, search, and recovery. We're setting up a medical camp here. You're going to find and bring in the injured, portal them to the city as needed, and portal back extra supplies."
"Sir, we have one of the devices. For all we know, it might be the one."
"It's definitely not," Keel said. "Asano annoys the Builder more than he does me, so he might swat all of you just for fun. There's no way they gave you the real thing."
"See?"
Neil asked. "What did I tell you?"
"Sir," Humphrey said, "given the stakes, I'm not sure we should be taking that risk."
"Fine," Keel said. "Pull out your device."
Clive looked to Humphrey, who nodded. Clive opened his rune portal storage space and pulled out a device the size of a hiking backpack.
Keel took a crystal from his pocket and held it near the device. The crystal turned red.
"There you go," Keel said. "Dummy device confirmed. Now stop asking questions and do what I tell you."
The adventurers fought their way through the city and into the deeper reaches through tunnels descending underground. The sense of alienness grew in the subterranean depths that were filled with industrial centers akin to foundries and ore refineries. Hot and humid, they were filled with dark corners and orange light. Tunnel warrens led deeper into the city's core, where the most important parts of the city were secured. Liara Rimeros had the true destructive device, and, as Sophie predicted, had been told its actual nature. She moved with two of her team members, the brother and sister pair Ledev and Yana. The trio of gold rank stealth specialists had been chosen as most likely to deliver the device successfully, which had largely proven true. After the dome went down, they had quickly penetrated the city, finding their way into the depths. As they moved deeper, however, it grew increasingly difficult to progress undetected through cramped tunnels filled with increasingly dangerous fixed defenses. They had been forced to fight through more and more constructs anchored in place to move forward, slowing their progress. The stealth specialists excelled at surprise attacks, not breaching emplaced defenses. They were caught up in running battles as the fight from the higher levels of the city caught up to their increasingly stalled progress. The only benefit was that people from their own side started to reach the team, teaming up for the final push. They joined a group that was mostly made up of adventurers whose teams had been split up by chaos or casualty. They had found one another and grouped up to push forward. It was a mixed group of golds and silvers, including Vespa and Jenny Cavaloa, whose team Vespa had been assigned to for the invasion. When Liara revealed they had the true device, the group pulled out all the stops to get them to their destination. Any cost was worthwhile to get it to the target zone. More than one sacrifice was made to get them closer, but as they approached the location, they were set upon by multiple groups of fresh cult defenders in quick succession. The problem facing the group was that once placed, they needed to escape before the device detonated. The ideal scenario had been the stealth team placing the device and it going undiscovered, but that no longer seemed viable. In a lull between attacks, Vespa addressed Liara.
"We're close now," Vespa told her. "Close enough that you can sneak the rest of the way if the rest of us grab enough attention."
"Vespa," Liara said.
"We don't have time to argue, Liara."
There was no time to discuss it, and the hasty plan was put into motion. Liara only paused a moment before hugging Vespa, nodding and moving off, her stealth powers rendering her invisible. Her brother and sister teammates did the same. The rest of the group moved to attack the converging cultists and trigger the emplaced defenses while the stealth trio continued on. Where they had previously avoided facing too many defenders at once, they now grabbed as much attention as they were able. The adventurers fought hard and savagely as Liara's trio avoided the final defenders between themselves and the target location. Although Liara's senses were reined in to avoid attention, the other group was close enough that she could sense their auras being snuffed out one by one. She stopped as she felt Vespa's aura wink out, stealing her resolve and stopping her aura from revealing their location with emotional turbulence. Liara only allowed herself a brief pause before continuing, and they reached the target zone undetected. The team took out the device and set it up in accordance with the instructions they were given. Unlike the people given dummy devices, the directions were more involved than push the big red button and run. "Now we go," Liara said when the job was done.
"Not me," Ledev said.
His sister paled.
"Ledev, no."
"There are still too many defenders roaming around,"
Ledev insisted.
"Of the three of us, I'm the only one with the power to hide this object from their senses now that it's out of its storage space and active."
"Brother!"
Liara's hand fell on Yana's shoulder.
"He's right, Yana. He can hide it for as long as it takes them to find him, buying everyone as much time to get out as possible before he sets it off."
One of the functions added to the dummy devices was that they would signal when the real device was activated, letting the adventurers know to retreat. From the moment the device had been turned on, the Rimuros forces had been pulling out. Yana clasped her brother in a death grip hug until he pushed her off.
"Time to go," he told her,
then turned to Liara.
"Just make sure the statue of me looks good. Yeah?"
The detonation didn't cause the flying city to explode. It trembled in the air, spiderweb cracks appearing on the underside of the disc. Geysers of force blasted out from the city above and the underside disc, blasting chunks of stone like giant cannonballs in every direction. The buildings of the city toppled as the interior of the floating city was annihilated by the nuclear bomb turned resonating force device. The main mass of the city held together, although the magic holding it aloft was gone. With incredible ponderousness, it started to fall from the sky. Below the flying city, Soromir gathered up all the power at his disposal, ignoring the diamond rank essence user who took the chance to land savage attacks. Gold rankers defended Soromir as he conjured up a vast and powerful storm in an attempt to slow and shift the trajectory of the falling island that threatened to land atop Liveros. More adventurers attempted to help, from telekinetic powers to just braving Soromir's storm to fly up to the falling city and push. Others dropped down, recognizing that even if the fortress city missed the island, it would create a massive tsunami. Rimuros had no shortage of water essence users, and they moved down to the island to prepare for what was about to come. Two figures rose up from Liveros below, flying into the air. Both were garbed in the robes of clergy, and their auras soared as they were filled with the power bestowed on them by their gods to protect the city. The Archbishop of Wind raised her arms and a great, focused, and continual blast of wind started pushing on the falling city. Gold rankers attempting to help were blasted away, but it didn't matter as the divine power shifted the trajectory of descent. Seeing the power at hand, the diamond rank cultist fled, which many of the cult's airships were already doing. The other clergywoman, the Archbishop of Ocean, became the vessel for her god's power and directed the sea to rise up. So vast was the quantity of water forming a rising column under the descending city that the sea level visibly dropped. The city struck the column, triggering an explosion of water that immediately sent rain falling over Liveros. The watery pillar slowed the descent of the plummeting city, turning a plunge into a drop. When it reached sea level, the city was still a massive falling object, displacing vast amounts of water to trigger a tsunami. But the Archbishop of Ocean was not done. She channeled more divine power, arresting the movement of the great wave and settling it back into the sea before it could strike Liveros or sweep out in search of other shores.
The fallen and collapsed city was too large to be entirely submerged, forming a new island off the coast of Liveros. Total disaster had been averted. Rimaros had been protected. But the death toll amongst adventurers was devastating. It would take time to fully count, but the royal family and their guard contingent had been ravaged, as had the other adventurers who fought for Rimaros instead of heading north. Jason's team had come through intact, courtesy of their assigned support role putting them in relative safety and giving them plenty of time to evacuate and help others to do the same. The moment they were certain they were safe, they found the shade body Jason had left in Liveros to inform him they had survived. Chapter 66. The End of the World. Some of the neighborhood kids watched from across the river as Rufus and Jason sparred. Stripped down to plain pants, they matched their swordsmanship furiously until even their silver rank endurance was spent. The children observed with fascination, some trying to imitate them, others engaging in their own spars using sticks. Jason lost repeatedly, despite all his advancements. Rufus had trained under what many considered to be the greatest swordsman in the world since he was a boy. For all of Jason's practical experience, it would take more than a few years and a few skill books to catch up. After exhausting themselves, they took a refreshing dip in the river. "I'm sure it would be different if we were using our powers," Rufus reassured Jason. "Uh-huh," Jason said skeptically. The Liveros Mirage Chamber had been shut down indefinitely. There were more important places to use the resources required to operate it. Rufus emerged from the water first and went into the cloud house. Jason extricated himself more slowly, picking his sword up from the grass and meandering back to the house as he looked around. He stopped, spotting someone outside another house further up the river. Estella Warnock was standing outside the house that had belonged to her grandfather, staring at it blankly. Jason hadn't sensed her, as she was one of the few people that could go unnoticed by his formidable senses. She didn't much bother with the polite restraint of aura, but instead completely hid it from everyone around her. Jason shot a delicate and supporting tendril of aura her way, and she turned. They shared a nod before she went into the house that now belonged to her. Jason looked at the house for a long time before Arabelle came out and stood beside him. "We don't have long before you'll need to head off again," she told him. "No skipping sessions, remember?" He nodded absently, still staring at the house that had belonged to Warwick Warnock. "It's strange, being on the outside of events like this," he said.
"Outside?"
"I didn't fight. I didn't lose anyone. This isn't my kingdom and this isn't my home."
"And where is your home?"
"My home is people. They all came back safe. I'm told it wasn't planned to keep them out of the city depths, but it was probably Dawn's doing. I'm so used to being in the middle of these events and losing things to them. It's strange to be on the periphery of someone else's fight." As with Jason's team, Arabelle had never been sent deeper into the city than the surface due to her valuable role as a healer. When the signal to evacuate came, she was able to escape safely.
"You may not have fought the Builder Cult," she told him, "but you did your part. You took lives again, and I know you want to avoid that."
"I know that's inevitable, with the choices I've made, the choices I'll make again." He looked at the sword in his hand, gripped halfway down the scabbard. "Maybe I could have crippled them with this instead of dosing them with afflictions. The bronze rankers. They might have lived long enough to get healing." He shook his head. "Mercy is good when I can afford it," he said. "I'm not going to take chances to save people like that."
"It sounds like you're starting to find your balance."
"Maybe. People are dealing with a lot more than I am right now. It feels like so much is happening all at once. The people of this kingdom don't even have time to grieve."
It had been a month since what was variously being called the War of Four Cities or the One Day War. The history books would decide which one stuck. The Storm Kingdom and the Adventure Society were still scrambling to adjust to a new status quo. Between the Rimuros battle and the battles to the northwest, the adventurer population had suffered massive casualties amongst their mid and high rankers. This included more than a third of the royal family's most powerful members, with the royal guard, the Sapphire Crown Guild, suffering similar losses. Despite their drop in numbers, both the royal family and the royal guard became more active in meat and potatoes adventuring in the wake of the battles. With their drop in numbers being reflected across the adventuring population, the Adventure Society was struggling to meet the requirements of Monster Surge activity. Once more, the royal family had stepped forward in the kingdom's time of need. Across all Adventure Society activity, minimum action quotas had been raised and safety standards lowered. Bronze rankers had not had their numbers diminished, as they had been kept out of the war. They now had their teams combined into larger groups and were sent on missions that would normally be tasked to silver rankers. All of these measures led to more losses, but the results of not doing so would be worse. Reports were already coming in of fortress towns having their defences overrun as monster clearing rates had dropped. Jason and his allies were no exception to the increased activity. They had been worked to the bone since the battle, but were holding up better than most. Their experience of spending months in an astral space in a ceaseless stream of battles, back when they were iron and bronze rank, left them mentally better prepared than most for the revolving door of contracts. For many Rimuros adventurers, the current adventuring climate was a terrible fit. The Rimuros adventuring ethos was predicated on turning situations into best-case scenarios, using their plentiful adventurer population and specialized teams to pick the right group for the right job. That was a rare luxury in current circumstances. While it was being done where possible, there were too many jobs and not enough adventurers. Many teams had lost members and been forced to amalgamate as best they could. Many of the young Rimuros silver rankers were unused to operating without high rank backup. The guild forces yet to be properly seasoned were revealing themselves as greenhouse flowers, especially at the bronze and early silver level, shrinking the gap between guild and non-guild adventurers. They might not have the depth of training enjoyed by their guild counterparts, but for most, this was not their first taste of desperation. Their mentality was holding up much better under adverse conditions. The good news in all the mess was that while the adventurers of the Storm Kingdom had seen their darkest hour, they had fought through and won. The lower rank adventurers and the population at large had been almost entirely shielded from the battles with the Builder. The region around the Rolling Land City had been burned into desolation and covered in molten metal and stone, but it was mostly empty desert. The nearest cities had already been evacuated before the land city rolled right through them, keeping casualties low. That made for a lot of refugees, but it was the territory of the kingdom to the north, saving the Storm Kingdom from needing to deal with them. As for the other two cities, the construct Kraken City had sunk to the bottom of the ocean after the most straightforward of the city battles. With the flying city that fell from the sky, the intervention of the gods had managed to shield Liveros. The most that had happened was minor coastal flooding on the islands of Provo and Arnot, as well as the south coast. The water essence users and the Archbishop of Ocean had protected Liveros entirely. The flying city was now a stony island just southwest of Liveros, having fallen into relatively shallow waters. Jason didn't know a lot of Rimuros adventurers, but he nonetheless went through casualty listings as they came out, along with most adventurers. The young he-who-would-be-Thadwick, who Jason had encountered during his first supply contract, had died. Although Jason didn't have the details, he liked to imagine that the young adventurer fell heroically, unlike his greenstone counterpart. There was no question that Ledev and Vesper had both died saving the city. Jenny Cavaloa had died fighting alongside Vesper as well. She might not have wanted to work with Jason again after their expedition together, but Jason had respected her a lot. He couldn't help but feel that his own sacrifices seemed hollow in comparison, given that he kept coming back from them. The World Phoenix wouldn't let Jason go until it was done with him,
which was how we ended up safely on Arnot, while the rest of the kingdom was fighting for their lives.
It feels a little odd,
Jason told Arabelle as they sat inside the cloud house. I'm used to being in the middle of these events, used to being the one to struggle and sacrifice. I've complained about it so much, but now I'm at the periphery. It feels wrong, somehow. I don't want any part of that, yet I'm somehow frustrated that I'm not. Am I lying to myself? Am I some kind of misery junkie?
You're not addicted to misery, Jason. You've become used to having an influence on affairs of a magnitude that you shouldn't even be involved with. Your frustration is from feeling a lack of control.
I never have control. I'm always dancing to someone else's tune, always too weak, always desperately leveraging someone else's power just to survive the path someone else put me on.
I don't believe that, Arabelle said, and neither do you.
Excuse me?
You have been making choices all this time. You and Farah have both told me about Earth. You chose to step in, time and again. No one forced you to work with people who betrayed you over and again. You chose to do that because of what would happen to innocent people if you didn't.
If it's between letting people die and working with people who suck, that isn't a choice.
Yes, Jason, it is. It's just an unpleasant one. And for all that you were kept from the battle, your influence was undeniably felt. It was your intervention that convinced Dawn to move, and you brought Travis into the fold to produce the weapon that destroyed the flying city. You were critical in felling two of those cities.
By leveraging other people's power, he said.
Again.
Arabelle gave him a sad, tired smile.
Jason, we have a long way to go, you and me. A very long way.
Jason didn't spend any more time than necessary on Liveros, just picking up and handing in contracts. Events had made his position in Rimaros politics fairly pointless. Anyone playing political games at the moment was being directly and savagely slapped down by Soromir. Even if he didn't, the Irios family had stepped up in a big way during the defense of Rimaros. Many of their members had fought and died, and their defense infrastructure had been critical. Petty games of young people and marriage no longer mattered. What little downtime Jason had was spent in training or working with Arabelle, starting the long road to getting his head straight. He spent a lot of his training time working on his swordsmanship with Rufus, who praised Jason's improvement while trouncing him repeatedly. Only remnants of the Builder cult remained in the Sea of Storms, and one of the most regular contracts Jason's team was given was rooting them out whenever they were found. In case they encountered a clockwork king or other gold rank minion, they usually did so in the company of Liara or Keel from the Builder Response Unit. Despite this task, the Builder cult was gone from the region for most practical purposes. The same could not be said for the rest of the world, as news rolled in of other battles with the Builder's terrible fortresses. The results were never great. Victory came at a heavy price, while defeat brought cataclysmic disaster. Stories came in of major cities annihilated, leaving the region's astral spaces ripe for seizure. That led to even more destruction as those astral spaces were plucked from the world. There were only a few small mercies in all the destruction and chaos. One was that with the current state of the world's dimensional membrane, the loss of astral spaces was less destructive than it had been in the past. With the dimensional barrier already weakened and damaged, the removal of astral spaces didn't create the same level of dimensional disturbance. The other good news was that the Builder cult was forced to accept the same limits as everyone else. The same low levels of magic in Greenstone that had prevented Emir's cloud ship from flying restricted the power of other things. The fortress cities in the Sea of Storms would have fallen out of the sky, sunk into the ocean, or even collapsed under their own weight in Greenstone. Each region was only faced with power commensurate with the power already there, making the Builder cult a challenge, but one that could be met on all fronts. They weren't always successful in stopping the Builder's ambitions, but more often than not, they were. Even in comparison to the other high magic zones, the Storm Kingdom successfully repelling three cities at once was a remarkable feat.
Their success buoyed other nations around the world, rejuvenating morale that was continuously being chipped away. If one of the world's great adventuring cities had fallen, the news could easily have led to a dangerous collapse of morale that fed the Builder cult's success. A month after the Builder's cities in the Storm Kingdom were destroyed, things were getting into some manner of tentative order. Mass memorials had been happening regularly. The fallen deserved better than to be sent off in job lots, but there wasn't time for anything more. The jobs hall had adventurers streaming in and out, grabbing fresh contracts the moment they handed in the one they just completed. The old biases between guild and non-guild dropped away in the scramble to meet the challenges of the monster surge. Guild elitism fell by the wayside as need and the shortcomings of training only in high magic zones highlighted the importance of experience. These were the shortcomings that the Geller family had understood for centuries. This was the very reason they had maintained Greenstone as their family seat, even as their power and influence spread across the world, generation after generation. Rufus had recognized this and had spent most of the last few years working to incorporate this practice into his family's academic institution. Stories abounded of people stepping up, of previously unknown individuals shining even as young adventurers vaunted for their potential cracked under pressure. This caused problems from both the higher and lower ends of society. In the upper echelons, some noble scions fell short after years of training and countless resources had been poured into them. Most aristocratic families were wise enough to brush the issue aside and subtly work on getting their young people the experience they needed to live up to their potential. The Geller family in Rimuros quietly made it known that they would help in this regard. A few houses took a different tack, however. In the rush to clean what they saw as stains to their pride, they made bold, short-sighted moves. Some cast out young people, like lizards dropping their tails, while others staged preemptive political smears to maintain the very reputation their actions were tainting. The small minority of aristocratic houses that made those decisions were mostly minor ones, panicked when their relatively limited power bases were harmed by the One Day War and its aftermath. Fearful of losing their influence in the royal court, they made moves that only threw that influence away as other houses and the royal family came down on them like a hammer. Titles were stripped and assets seized from any family that too openly defied the royal family's edict that politics would be set aside through the current crisis. There were always those who thought the rules did not apply to them, or that they were too clever to be caught out in their ambitions. In the case of one minor family, their entire Sky Island was seized by the royal family. The aristocratic house in question mounted protests until Soromir and Zila Rimuros personally came to the island, smashed through the defences, and threw anyone who would survive directly off the side of the island. The rest of the family departed swiftly. Adventurers shining bright during dark days were welcomed into guilds hungry to replenish their numbers and add experienced adventurers to their roster. Families whose members had stepped up in the battle or the aftermath, either as adventurers or through more logistical contributions, were raised to the status of minor nobility. At the lower end of the social spectrum were those who saw this and viewed the current conditions as a prime chance to move up in the world. While most realized that those being recognized were doing so through earnest effort, many couldn't see past selfish ambitions or that the old ways were changing. As with the noble families, who had shot themselves in the foot, many failed to see that a fundamental shift was taking place in both the adventuring and aristocratic realms of Rimuros society. They stuck to the old ways of backroom influence trading and putting more effort into looking like they were contributing than actually doing it. They tried to move up by pulling others down, sowing mistrust at a time when unity was critical. The royal family did what they could to stamp it out, but being less prominent, the lowly and ambitious were harder to notice and identify.
How long before you're back on a contract? Arabelle asked Jason.
We're going in this evening, Jason told her, looking out the cloudhouse window at the early afternoon sun.
Not much of a break. You only got back this morning. You won't even spend a night at home.
There's not much Builder cult left to mop up, Jason said. We've been getting a lot of missions to reinforce fortress towns now that I have a lot of them as portal destinations,
I'm guessing they're keeping you busy too?
Yes. With greater risks being taken, the need for healers has risen commensurately. That's not an excuse to avoid these sessions.
It kind of is.
We have the rest of the day, then.
All day? Arabelle, I need rest and relaxation too, you know.
Just a little longer, then. But it has to be about something I want to go back to.
What? Jason asked warily.
You told me that your family stayed in the Cloud House after you lost control of your aura during a flashback nightmare.
That's old news, Jason said. They're back on Earth.
Did they ever go back into your spirit vault after that?
That takes trust, Jason said. We never talked about it again. We all knew they wouldn't be able to go in anymore.
How did that make you feel?
Alone? That was when I knew they weren't coming back with me. It took longer to admit to myself, but that was when I knew.
And what about your team?
Arabelle asked. What about them?
Have they gone into your spirit vault?
I haven't told them about it.
Why not?
You know why not.
Tell me.
You're going to make me say it.
Some things you have to go through to get to the other side, Jason.
He stood and paced around the room. Arabelle remained seated, patiently waiting. More than once he paused to glower at her before he resumed his angry pacing. Finally, he leaned up against the wall, pressing into it with both hands as he glared out the window.
Jason?
Arabelle said. Because if they can't go in, I'm done, Jason yelled, wheeling on her. If after everything I went through to get here, they can't trust me, I won't have anything left. Nothing to go towards and nothing to go back to. Is that what you want to hear?
Yes, Arabelle said calmly. This fear is what's stopping you from moving forward. But you already know that.
You're saying I have to do it?
Jason, you need to understand that just because something is one way in any given moment, that doesn't mean it's that way forever. My understanding is that your spirit vault requires a deep and unreserved trust in you before someone can enter.
Yes.
Then do you genuinely believe it's strange that your team might have some reservations about you coming back from the dead so very different than you were before? That trust you once had was built over time, strengthened in fire like a pot in a kiln. If they don't have that full and absolute trust today, you need to understand that it's not the end. You have the time and the chance to build that trust again. So yes, I'm saying that you have to tell them about your spirit vault and let them in. You don't have to tell them about the trust component. You can see how it goes.
You think it's that easy?
No. But you're in a place where you have to confront what is, in your mind, the worst possible outcome before you can see that it isn't the end of the world and you do have a path forward. You faced the literal end of the world, Jason. Are you going to let a metaphorical one stop you?
So it's not a portal, Neil said. That's a personal storage space, except that people can go in. Something like that, Jason said. Jason and his team, along with Rufus, Gary, and Farah, were standing in the waterfall room, looking at a portal arch. Rufus looked at Jason, who seemed normal and light-hearted, but saw that Farah was watching him with concern. He knew there was something about the arch that they weren't telling the rest of them. Clive was the most eager, curiosity driving him to vanish through the portal first. Gary quickly followed. Farah nodded at Rufus, and he followed suit. Humphrey was next, Sophie right on his heels. Belinda followed right behind, Jason's inattention loosening just a little. Belinda was one he'd been unsure of, but that just left Farah and Neil. Neil shrugged, bit into his sandwich, and walked through the portal. Left alone with Farah, Jason staggered, as if a cord that had been pulled tight within him had suddenly loosened.
Farah flashed him a grin and grabbed him up in a hug. Tears Jason's magical body shouldn't have been able to shed welled in his eyes. Farah was almost holding him up when Neil came back out of the portal.
Are you two coming, or?
He saw them holding one another.
Ha! I knew it! Lindy, you owe me a...
She probably can't hear me. Neil turned to go back through the archway when Jason rushed over and bundled him into a huge hug. This is the end of He Who Fights With Monsters 7, a lit RPG adventure, a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more heroic adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to He Who Fights With Monsters 7, a lit RPG adventure, Book 7 of He Who Fights With Monsters, produced by Emily Durr, written by Shirtaloon, aka Travis Deverell, performed by Heath Miller. Text copyright 2022 by Travis Deverell. Production copyright 2022 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.